I'm Jeremy. I'm one of the ministers here, and I'm originally from Starkville, Mississippi. That's where I grew up. My wife, meanwhile, is from Indiana, a very small town, actually called Plainville, Indiana. It's an apt name. And we met and went to school in West Tennessee, and then we worked in Nashville for about 4 years before we moved here. And I give you that brief history of our lives to tell you that I didn't really know anything about Kentucky or Lexington before we moved here. I don't think I'd ever been to Kentucky before we moved here. In fact, a few weeks before we moved to Lexington, I saw that a friend of mine was moving to Kentucky online. And I looked and it said he was moving to Nicholasville. And I told Susanna, I said, hey, look, so-and-so's moving to Nicholasville. Let's see if that's close to Lexington. Well, it was, right? I had no clue. I didn't know anything about Kentucky. We actually moved to Lexington on April 2nd, 2012. And this really shows you how little I knew about Lexington. Some of you know the significance of that date. April 2nd, 2012 was... Yeah, it was the championship, right? It was the 2012 NCAA championship game between UK and Kansas. I'm not much of a sports guy. I don't follow sports very closely. And Chad Wadlington had been our contact person. He was the guy who was helping us get up here and arrange everything for us and super helpful. But when we told him we were moving on April 2nd, he told us, he said, well, no one will be able to help you move because of the basketball game. And I thought he was joking, and he wasn't. He wasn't. So we didn't know. We just didn't know a lot about Lexington or Kentucky. But as of April this year, we will have lived in Lexington for 8 years. 8 years. That's much longer than anywhere I've lived since I graduated high school, right? And now I know what Keeneland is. You know, I can correctly pronounce Versailles and Athens and Louisville. You know, Lexington is our home now. Now, some of you have lived here much longer, so I'd like to do some hands real quick. Let's do hands up if you've lived here for 10 years or longer. All right, hands up. All right, keep your hands up if you've lived here 20 years or longer. All right, if you've lived here 30 years or longer. If you've lived here over 40 years, hands up. Man, that's awesome. Okay, that's awesome. Well, some of you will be much better equipped to answer this next question than I am. But I have a question for us to ponder today, and it's this. If you live in Lexington, what are the things you should not miss doing? If you live in Lexington, what are the things you should not miss doing? And we could probably go around the room and get a lot of really great answers. But here is TripAdvisor's list of top things to do in Lexington. Okay, here's their list. We can pull that up. Now, maybe you agree or maybe you disagree with these, right? So we've got Keeneland, we've got the Kentucky Horse Park. Let's go one more. Yeah, the Marriott Lincoln House, Thoroughbred Center, right? So all these things, these are the top five things they say to do in Lexington. And maybe you disagree with these and you would put your own list up there. But I would like us to take note of something. And it's this, you can live in Lexington without ever doing any of the top things to do in Lexington. Even if your list is different, right? You can live in Lexington without ever doing those things. You can go about your day-to-day life kind of ignoring these or whatever you think the best things to do are, and that's fine. It's okay. It doesn't make you a bad person if you never do the top things Lexington has to offer. It doesn't mean anything's wrong with you. It doesn't mean you aren't a true Lexingtonian, right? But it does mean that you're missing out on some of the better things that Lexington has to offer. And that idea that you can be part of something but not experience the fullness of it is also true of spiritual disciplines, okay? It's also true of spiritual disciplines. About a month and a half ago, I got the opportunity to talk a little bit about spiritual disciplines, and I just kind of want to recap what I think is a really important point, and it's this, that you can go through life without practicing spiritual disciplines. They don't save you. They don't make you better than someone else. We're all equally dependent on Jesus saving us, right? No matter how often you read your Bible or pray or fast or give, you need Jesus just as much as anyone else. But if you never experience them, if you never practice spiritual disciplines, you're missing out on some of the wonder and the mystery and the adventure that being a Christian, that following Jesus involves. You know, Jesus talks about having fullness of life in John 10:10, and spiritual disciplines, they open us up to more of that fullness. Like I said, about a month and a half ago, I got to talk a little bit about spiritual disciplines, and we talked about the disciplines of silence and solitude. Now, you may have found it very difficult during the holidays to practice silence and solitude, but if you were able to slip away from the noise and the crowds, my guess is that you were blessed by it. I know that my experience of silence and solitude has been when I'm able to get it, when I'm able to slip away and find that, it just makes me want more of it. And now it's the new year. It's 2020, and it's a time when people in our country consider how they would like this year to be different. And maybe you've made some New Year's resolutions, or maybe you don't really get into New Year's resolutions, but people all across our country do. They make resolutions to change and to do things in a better, different way this year. And I think that this makes this a great time to consider our spiritual disciplines. So let me encourage you this morning, if you're going to make any changes this year, if you're going to make some resolutions, include spiritual disciplines on your list. I think you will find a much richer and deeper return compared to many of our traditional resolutions. And speaking of those traditional resolutions, I went online, I looked to find what are the top three resolutions people make every year. And you can probably guess these, all right? I'm sure you could have come up with this, right? But here they are. It's to exercise more, to lose weight, and to get organized. And there are others that are usually around the top. To make better financial decisions is usually up there. But regardless, from year to year, it doesn't change. These are always the top three resolutions that people make. I don't know why, for certain, these three are on top, but I think I can make a pretty educated guess. You know, we've just had Christmas, right? And maybe your family got together and everyone brought that dish that they're famous for. To brag on my wife a little bit, she makes incredible peanut butter fudge, and she made it this Christmas, and I ate a lot, okay? And so you get together and you have all these huge meals, and you eat too much, and you can feel that you ate too much, and you look down and you can see that you ate too much, and when you go to get up off the couch, it takes you about half a second longer than it used to, right? And so we think to ourselves, I need to exercise. I need to lose some weight. And so our list of New Year's resolutions are started. Or maybe after all the presents are unwrapped and you're searching for a place to put everything, you find that the drawers are already too packed to fit your new clothes in there. Or your children's toys are flooding the house. Listen, Suzanne and I, we have a two-year-old. We are learning a lot about the parenting thing. And one thing I've learned is that you grandparents out there, or at least Gavin's grandparents, you're not concerned about the storage capacity of our homes, okay? You don't really take that into account, all right? And so with new stuff, you know, bursting out of our homes, we say, I really need to get organized. I've got a little too much to handle. And maybe that's why these are the top three resolutions each year. Maybe not. Maybe my theory is wrong. But I'm certain of one thing, and that's that these three resolutions reflect that we live in a culture of more. We live in a culture obsessed with the idea of more. The fact that every single year as a nation, we reflect and we take a collective gasp and we all say, wow, I've eaten too much, I have too much, I better change it. And we do that every single year. It demonstrates this deep-rooted problem that our culture is obsessed with, that we're always pursuing more in the false belief that more will make us happy. And of course, what do we know about New Year's resolutions? How long do they last? Barely any make it past January, right? Our commitments to living with less don't tend to last very long. And you're probably very well acquainted with the more mentality of our culture, but I'd like to provide a few examples. The first one goes back to the 1950s, just to show that the more mentality is not a new thing, okay? This is an ad, right? And if you can see, it says, TV adds so much to family happiness. And so what's the underlying message here? That whatever it is you have right now, whatever good thing you've got going on with your family, it could be better. You could have more if you only had more. It makes you wonder how families were ever happy without TVs, right? Or how about Apple's new phone lineup, right? Look at it from year to year to year. If the cell phone market has taught us anything, it's that every year there will be something better newer, with better features, and you're missing out if you don't have it. Next up is a Cadillac commercial from 2014. Let's to watch. Look, that's going to be a file format problem on my end, okay? So we can just skip the video. We can skip the video, all right? Sorry about that. But let me instead share some statistics with you, okay? So Americans eat 815 billion calories of food each day. That's 200 billion more than needed, which is enough to feed 80 million people. That's every day we eat an excess of 80 million people's worth of food. We throw out 200,000 tons of edible food every single day. We generate 52 tons of garbage each by the age of 75. The average individual daily consumption of water is 159 gallons, while over half the world's population lives on 25. And then this quote, with less than 5% of the world population, right? So the U.S. is less than 5% of the world. We use 1/3 of the world's paper, 1/4 of the world's oil, 23% of the coal, 27% of the aluminum, and 19% of the copper. And the thing I want us to see is that we live in a culture where excess is celebrated and encouraged, and waste is expected. So with that in mind, I'd like us to spend some time in this passage that we read, Matthew 6. Matthew 6, and we're going to focus on verses 19 through 24 this morning. This passage is the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus, he spends the first half of chapter 6 talking about the temptation of doing righteous acts to receive the praise of others rather than to glorify God. And so he talks about giving to the needy, and he says, don't let your right hand see what your left is doing. And he talks about prayer, and he says, go into your closet and pray in private. Don't make a show of it. And then he gets to fasting. And again, in his discussion of fasting, he highlights you don't fast for the attention or praise of others. But after he talks about fasting, he immediately launches into a new topic. He begins talking about the more mentality. Because there's a connection between fasting and the pursuit of more. The spiritual disciplines that I want us to look at, to think about this morning, are fasting and frugality, okay? Fasting and frugality. I think we'll see in this text that those spiritual disciplines are what help us resist this temptation to seek fulfillment in that pursuit of more stuff. So let's read verses 19 through 24 of Matthew 6 together. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. In these three paragraphs here, Jesus gives us these three examples, these three metaphors, and each one poses us with a powerful question that gets to the heart of the material-obsessed more mentality. So I want us to look at these three paragraphs here and kind of see what these three questions Jesus sets before us are. Verses 19 through 21 deal with where we stockpile our treasure, right? On earth or in heaven? Are we investing in our temporary lives now or preparing for our eternal lives after Jesus' return? Jesus says, well, it's just common sense, right? To invest your treasure in eternity, because treasure on earth won't last. So don't waste your time, don't waste your energy on the temporary. But I think there's actually a larger implication here, because Jesus also says, where your treasure is, your heart will be also. And I think we tend to think of our hearts as like emotional investment, right? A symbol for emotional investment. But I think there's more to this here, because what also happens to go wherever your heart goes? You do, right? Yeah, your heart doesn't go very far without you, right? And so wherever you put your treasure, whatever you build your life on, that's where your heart will be, and by extension, that's where you will be. And if you build your life on temporary things that decay, then you too will one day decay. You won't last. But if you build your life on eternal things, on Jesus, then you too will last. And so question number one that Jesus kind of sets before us is, where is your treasure? Now, verses 22 through 23 have always been a bit confusing to me. It's all this talk of eyes and lamps, light and darkness. In the ancient world, eyes were commonly used to kind of represent inner good or evil. Okay, so a good or healthy eye was one that shed the light of generosity and represented good moral character. And you can actually see this play out in the Old Testament. Proverbs 22, verse 9, it says, "Whoever has a good eye will be blessed, for he shares his bread with the poor." So there in Proverbs, the idea of a good eye represents generosity, right? Sharing what you have with the poor. Meanwhile, a bad or an unhealthy eye represented selfishness or greed, envy, and just general poor moral character. Again, you can see it in the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 15, verse 9 says, "Take care lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart, and you say, 'The seventh year, the year of release is near,' and your eye look evil on your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cried to the Lord against you, and you be guilty of sin." So again, here we see, you know, we see a bad eye, an evil eye, an unhealthy eye connected with selfishness and greed. In fact, both of these Old Testament examples have to do with one's perspective on stuff, your attitude towards things, on materialism, on greed and generosity. And so if you look at all the stuff in the world and you see it as a gift to share with others and to use for God's glory, then you have good eyes. You're seeing things clearly the way they're supposed to be. But if you look at the stuff in the world and you say, "That's mine, it's for me, I deserve it, I earned it, mine," then your life will be darkened. You have bad eyes. "That's mine," that's a phrase that's kind of personal to me right now because I hear it a lot with Gavin being 2 years old, okay? "That's mine." He's very concerned right now about who possesses what and what belongs to who. So that's daddy's, that's mommy's, that's mine. You know, he's just trying to figure it all out, right? And if I can just be honest, it's really hard to talk about materialism and greed and the more mentality right after Christmas, having a two-year-old. I want Gavin to have all these toys to play with and learn, right? I want him to get to experience all those things. But I do worry sometimes. It's too much. I get a little scared sometimes of the stuff in his life. I'm afraid it's not good for him. And so we've been talking about this. We took Gavin to the store to buy a gift for his friend that lives across the street, to buy a Christmas present for his little neighborhood friend. He has a buddy who's just 2 months younger than him that lives right across the street from us. And so Gavin went and he picked out a pack of dinosaurs, okay? This really cool pack of dinosaur toys. And, you know, it was a little hard for him to come to terms with it not being for him, but he was. He was kind of excited to get it for his friend. Like, he was kind of on board. He got it. But then Gavin got sick, so we didn't get to take it immediately to his friend. And then our neighbors went out of town for 2 weeks. And so that pack of dinosaurs has been sitting in our house for 2 weeks, okay? 2 weeks, Gavin sees it every day, sitting there, still in the box. And it's hard. It's hard to see those dinosaurs day after day and not play with them, right? And finally, he had taken all he could, I think. He really wanted to play with those dinosaurs, and he just kind of broke down. "I want to play with them. They're mine, mine. I want them. I want to play with them." And eventually, he came back around. You know, we talked through it. We worked it out. And he remembered that they're for his friend, and he was fine with it eventually, okay? But it does remind me, right, that we have a tendency to have bad eyes. There's something in us that we see stuff and we forget what it's really for. We see stuff, money, clothes, things, and we think of how it can be good for us instead of how it can be good for others, how it can glorify God. And so the question is, when you look at the world, when you go to work, when you practice a sport, when you study for a test, do you do it for others? Do you do it for God? Do you do it for you? The second question Jesus puts before us is, how are your eyes? Are they healthy or unhealthy? Good or bad? The third paragraph, starting there in verse 24, I think the message here is a little more straightforward, right? You cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and money. You either serve stuff or you serve God. Question three is very simple. Who is your master? Who is your master? I want to show a picture to you. All right. You may recognize what this is. This is a tiny house, okay? This is a tiny house. It's kind of part of this movement of people selling their homes and building these really small houses and living simply. You're talking like 600 square feet and below, right? It's very simple living. And it has kind of become pretty popular. It kind of exploded in popularity, and there were TV shows about it, and people were selling all their stuff and building these. And I saw an interview where a tiny house owner was asked why. Why would you do this? And they said this. Here was their answer. I thought it was great. I thought it was interesting. We work hard to afford bigger houses than we need. We continue to work so we can fill our houses with more stuff, items we may not need but buy anyway. Many Americans are overwhelmed by their packed schedules and obligations. They're tired of running in the rat race. And I think that quote lines up with what Jesus is saying in Matthew 6, 19 through 24. I think it hits on this important truth that we enslave ourselves to material things. They take over. These things that we're supposed to own, they end up owning us, and they drag our hearts away from God and us along with our hearts. And they ruin our eyes, and they make us greedy and selfish, and they become our masters. When we talked about silence and solitude, I did a little quiz to determine if you're afraid of silence and solitude. I have a quiz today to help you determine if you have too much stuff, okay? You already know the answer, I bet. I bet you can answer. But here's how to tell if you have too much. If you have more pairs of shoes than there are days in the week, maybe you have too much stuff. If you have trouble closing your clothes drawers. If you have electronics that are never touched, do you have a drawer or a bin for unused electronics that you haven't touched in 6 years, okay? Maybe you have too much stuff. Do you have a garage, but you can't park in it, right? If you don't have to unpack after a trip, what I mean by that, you pack up your clothes for a week and you go somewhere and you come back and you can leave them in the suitcase because you have plenty of other clothes that you can still live off of. You never even have to unpack. It can just stay in the suitcase. Can you lose things in your room? Did you binge watch Marie Kondo when it came out, right? Do you have that closet that you're scared to open because you know what's on the other side of the door? I mean, my guess is that all of us, right, all of us can answer yes to some of those questions. So what do we do? How do we push back against the more mentality of our culture? How do we avoid enslavement to materialism, to objects, to stuff? Well, this morning I want us to consider the spiritual disciplines of fasting and frugality, okay? Fasting and frugality. So fasting is the practice of going without something, traditionally food or drink, for a specific amount of time, right? Fasting primarily helps us to focus on God. The hunger pangs of fasting remind us to think about Him and to focus our hearts on Him. It's a continual reminder throughout the day. Fasting also helps us discover God as our source of strength. When Jesus was fasting in the desert, He was tempted to turn stones into loaves of bread by Satan. And He said, man does not live on bread alone, but what? But on every word that comes from the mouth of God. There's another time in John 4 where Jesus' disciples, they urge Him to eat. They say, you must be hungry, eat some food. And He responds, I have food to eat that you know nothing about. My food is to do the will of Him who sent me and to finish the work. So when we fast, we're reminded that God is our greater source of strength. And in abstaining from food and drink, we discover that. Fasting also helps free us from the control of our desires. We talked about how material things enslave us. They take over. Well, fasting will reveal to you what controls you. It'll be the thing you find yourself missing the most, right? It's the thing that maybe right now you're thinking, I do not want to fast from that. And that's probably the thing we need to fast from, right? And through this practice of abstaining from food and drink, God can break our bondage, our slavery, to satisfying ourselves. Sometimes our desires and our self-satisfaction becomes our master, and fasting helps us with that. And then fasting also reveals our own character more clearly. You will get to know yourself better when you fast. right? You may recognize some parts of you that you'd rather not confront that kind of bubble to the surface during fasting. Richard Foster, he wrote the book Celebration of Discipline, and I would recommend that book primarily as a source to study and look more into spiritual disciplines. And he wrote this about fasting. He said, "Anger, bitterness, jealousy, strife, fear, if they are within us, they will surface during fasting." And some of you are thinking, well, I don't even have to skip a meal, you know. If I'm just like 30 minutes behind lunch, I start to feel those things, right? But in fasting, we get to see those things. We get to notice those things, confront them. And the beauty of this is that when we do, we can open ourselves up to allow God to work on them. I do think maybe there's some misconceptions about fasting. There are some things that fasting is not about. One, fasting is not for, it's not a command or a law, right? However, it's often assumed to be a normal part of the life of Jesus' followers. The verse we read today, Matthew 6:16, says, "When you fast," it kind of assumes that, Jesus kind of assumes that his listeners are people who fast. And so while we shouldn't wield it against anyone as some sort of standard to hold them to, it does seem to be assumed to be a normal part of a disciple's life. It's also not for impressing others. Jesus' main point there in Matthew 6:16-18 is that you should not make a show of it, right? It doesn't make you superior to anyone. Fasting is not about the attention you'll get from other people. It's about focusing on God. And it doesn't manipulate God, right? We don't go on hunger strikes to force God's hand. When we want something really bad, we don't just turn up the pressure on God by fasting. Fasting is not an attempt to manipulate him for our own aims, but it helps us see more clearly what God is doing and where he's working. So I'd like to share a little practical advice maybe on fasting. I do not consider myself an expert on fasting or anything like that. You know, in fact, when I was in college one time, I decided to fast for a day, and this speaks to my spiritual immaturity at the time, or just general immaturity, I don't know. But I fasted for the whole day, and I was very hungry, and the minute it hit midnight, I made this huge thing of that Velveeta queso dip and ate an entire bag of chips. I don't think I really got it, right? I don't think I really understood what fasting was about. But I do think these are some good practical advice on fasting. First thing is to remember the purpose. Don't let the discomfort of fasting distract from why you're doing it. Let the discomfort refocus you, reorient you on why you're doing it. Start out small. Maybe take small steps by fasting for one or two meals one day a week, and then increase that as is appropriate. Talk to your doctor, of course. Consider your health. And again, let me direct you to Richard Foster's book, Celebration of Discipline. He has some really great practical advice on fasting. And then finally, meditate on Scripture. During that time when you would be eating, instead spend some time reading God's Word. Be reminded that we live on more than bread alone. Right? That we have other sources of strength, and that God's Word is one of those. So that's fasting. It's maybe some practical advice, and maybe you can consider how you might incorporate that into your life. In the battle against the more mentality of our culture, the companion to fasting is frugality. Okay, frugality. Maybe not a word you use every day, right? But frugality is not dumpster diving, and it's not only shopping on sale. It's also not being cheap or stingy now so that you can be rich later, okay? That's kind of just another way of being obsessed with stuff. At the same time, frugality is not romanticizing poverty, all right? Frugality is about our inner attitude towards stuff, okay? It's about removing our desire for status, for glamour, for luxury, and is primarily concerned with our attitude toward money or goods or food. It's ultimately about those three questions we saw back in Matthew 6. Where is your treasure? How are your eyes? Who is your master? Frugality, it pushes back against the materialism of our culture that worms its way into our hearts. It takes a stand against the casual waste that is the norm in our society. And it reminds us that our time is a gift from God that, like every gift from him, should not be wasted or abused. Frugality, maybe summed up, is about investment of time, of money, of thought, and of energy. In practicing it, we refrain from spending those things on indifferent things so that we can be free to spend them on things that are eternal. Eternal. So here are some suggestions on how to practice frugality. One, inventory. Okay, so go through your things and decide what is necessary and what is luxury, right? Luxury is by definition unnecessary, right? We don't need it. So you can ask yourself some questions. Would I give this up if God asked me to? Could the time, energy, and money I spent acquiring this be used in better ways? Ask God maybe how he would have you use those luxuries for his glory. Another suggestion is to reconsider. Before you make a big purchase, submit it to God in prayer. Search out your own personal motives for buying it. Maybe talk to someone who knows you well, who can help you, give you some insight as to why you're making that purchase. Are you doing it to keep up with others or impress them? Is it to serve an appetite of yours that's been spoiled? Is it to have the latest and greatest? Or is it to serve others and bring God glory? I think one cool way to help reconsider our habits towards stuff is to do a no-spend month, okay, a no-spend month where you don't buy anything that is not a necessity, like food, right? And so you don't spend any extra money, do a no-spend month. It's not really about the saving of money. It's about the practice of recognizing what you need and what's necessity and what's excess and what's luxury. And I think a practice like that will help you reconsider the way you think about stuff. You can reschedule. Time is a wonderful gift from God that's easy to waste, right? So you can go through your daily schedule and make a note of what percentage of your thoughts are spent dwelling on just material things, right? Commit yourself to refrain from spending inappropriate amounts of time thinking about things that do not matter, and ask God to help bring your thoughts under his control, to take every thought captive for Christ. And then finally, repurpose. And that's just give stuff away, okay? Maybe take a week where you give away one thing every single day, every single day. Someone who was great about this in my life was Amanda Jones. She was a great example of this to me. She was always giving away stuff. She was trying to limit the amount of stuff she had. There's probably a lot of people in this room that have Amanda Jones stuff that was passed down to them. And one thing she did that was not cool, she would always try to give me her leftover yogurt. I was like, Amanda, you do not share dairy, okay? But she was great about repurposing, about giving things away, and I really respected that about her and appreciate that about her. So, again, those are maybe some practical ways to practice frugality, to grow that spiritual discipline in your life. And really, I'd like to just encourage you to do it, to try it. You know, sometime this next week or month, practice fasting or frugality or both, right? Even better. Give something away each day this week. Pick a meal and fast from it. Do a no-spend month. These spiritual disciplines, they fly in the face of everything our ad-inundated, material-obsessed, more mentality culture would have us believe, and they will help you embrace the freedom that Jesus offers from enslavement to material things. Back in May, you may have seen this on the news. Back in May, there was a passenger plane flying over Russia, and it was struck by lightning. And they had to do an emergency landing in Moscow, and as they were landing, the plane caught fire. It burst into flames. And so they were able to, they had a rough landing, and they were evacuated down those emergency slides that come out of the plane. But 41 people died in the fire. It was tragic. It was terrible. And later, reports from the plane personnel surfaced, and they said that the evacuation was slowed because passengers were stopping to get out their bags before they left the plane. They actually issued a statement that said, "We'll never know if more lives could have been saved if the bags were left behind." And that is why Jesus says what he says about the dangers of the more mentality. It's not because Jesus wants us to be unhappy, right? It's not because he doesn't want us to have good things. It's because he wants us to have the best things, the things that really matter, a relationship with God who is the source of life and joy and love and truth. And Jesus knows that our tendency is to instead choose things that will decay. We'll have bad eyes. We will build our lives on things that won't last, and they will enslave us and destroy us. We will walk into the fire on the plane that will kill us just to retrieve something that will be outdated, obsolete, and replaced 3 months later. And so Jesus asks, where's your treasure? How are your eyes? Perhaps most importantly, who is your master? Other masters will enslave. and destroy you, ultimately. There's only one who can set you free from death and slavery and give you true fullness of life. And if Jesus is not your master, the king of your life, then this is a great place to talk to some people who have been following him for a long time. We have people in the back who would love to pray with you here in a moment. If you just walk through those doors, there are people who can pray with you or who'd be happy to talk to you about Jesus. If there's other things you'd like to pray about, they would love to do that with you too. If there's any other way we can help you this morning, let us know as we stand and sing.